So, our learning objectives for today, for those of you that would like CPD certificates, are: what are the key impacts of the recent change and proposed IHT changes? Which protection contracts are best suited to IHT planning? Whole of life versus joint life, second death term, compare the benefits, and issues to treat with caution when advising on IHT. Although, to be fair, given the notes and the points that our panelists have said they want to cover during the discussion, I think we're going to cover that and a whole lot more. I'll begin, if I may, by inviting our panelists to introduce themselves. If they could just give details of their firm, their background, a little bit of their specialisation. Can I do it in alphabetical order and come to Ed Green first, then? Ed, if you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Ian. Hopefully you can hear me okay. Yeah,
All clear.
good. Okay. I'm a fellow of the PFS and certified financial planner. I have my own firm, Gordian Wealth Management Limited, which is an IFA. I've been advising for somewhere between 25 and 30 years. I don't know exactly when. I've worked it all out, but a good period of time. Most of my clients are business owners, entrepreneurs, professionals, generally pretty wealthy and affluent people. And I deal with multiple generations of their families, etc. I have about 50, 55 families I look after, and generally look after people in a very deep and close fashion.
Okay, thanks very much. Could I have come to Harry next, please? If you could introduce yourself to everybody, that'd be great.
Hi there, my name is Harry Vecchia. I run my own firm. I've been in financial services in 1987. We started in the protection area and the mortgages area many, many years ago. And in 2008, I think when the mortgage market crashed, we decided that financial planning was an additional arm. So what we've done since then is really educate ourselves. I'm a chartered financial planner. I'm also STEP qualified or TEP qualified. I've given up the rights to use that things because I didn't feel I wanted to pay a subscription to it. So I don't, but I am qualified for that. My aim is with my clients is to educate them. I feel our clients are clever enough to make decisions and they know themselves much, much better than I do. So my role is to educate and explore different areas, not just the financial planning areas where we get paid. So that's who I am.
Thank you, Harry. Thanks very much. And lastly, Ross.
I also run my own firm, Braid Financial Planning, and I've been in financial services my whole career and been advising a bit like Harry. Started off in mortgage and protection for the first 10 years, and then in 2012 decided to broaden the scope and move into full financial planning. A chartered financial planner, a member of the PFS, and I'm also a member of the STEP Scotland committee branch. So help with kind of running the STEP organisation up here north of the border.
Great, thanks very much. And for our panelists, as you know, you've each submitted a series of points you think it's important to cover. So as we're going through the discussion, I'll be coming to you on some of the points that you've shared with us. Sometimes these sessions, we find the audience picks up very quickly and we end off covering a wide range of topics. I will come back towards the end and make sure that we've explicitly covered the learning objectives that we had. But Ed, the first thing you were talking about in the notes you shared with me were review of current strategies. So can I invite you to start us off by looking at how you would approach that element?
Yeah, well, this is relating to the budget from last year and the impact of clients on clients of those proposed changes. I think one of the key things probably to stress in that is that they're still proposed. Nothing has been absolutely buttoned down quite yet. There's a bit of background noise. I don't know if that's hopefully that's yeah, okay. The the key things that clients have been concerned about is the changes to pensions. Pensions being brought into the estate from April 27, and also changes to business relief and agricultural relief. So essentially, when we have seen clients following the budget, it's looking at the impact of that. What changes are required? Is there anything sensible we can do to counter some of these proposals? And in some cases, it's a complete rethink of their overall estate planning. With a number of clients, they're in the lucky position of not having to use their pensions. So their pensions have been left intact and parked, you know, potentially for future generations. But now, or at least from April 27 onwards, that's no longer the case. So pensions are being brought in alongside their investment strategies and, you know, rental income or whatever as part of the overall income pot. And it's debating, you know, how best to use that to maybe fund life policies to deal with the increased inheritance tax liability. So it's bringing those into play. It's almost going back to the drawing board for many clients.
Okay, and if I come then to Harry, a point you made in your initial message was looking at the ability to mitigate IHT for up to 125 years. So can I pick on that? I know that relates to putting things in trust, but ask you to sort of expand on that point a little bit further.
Yeah, I think when we do protection planning, if we do it properly, there's going to be a significant amount of money unfortunately paid at a very sad event for a family. They're faced with two different elements. One is the fact that they've literally unfortunately won a lottery. And if we understand that lots of people who win lots of money or gain lots of money are not in a position to handle it properly, that's the first thing. Secondly, they're in an emotional turmoil. They have no idea, and they've got all these people coming around to them trying to sell them something or do something untoward, not for the best interest of the client. So what we try and do is we try and explain to them the consequences of not putting their policies into trust. We explain to them what actually happens when the policy goes into trust, what they can do. And we also explain to them what's going to happen when, unfortunately, an event ends up happening. So what they've got is they've got an experience, a mental experience about what's going to happen. And we also point to them that they don't have to use us. They can use anyone in the market. But what they want to do is they want to surround themselves with people who they've trusted. Hopefully, if you've built up a relationship, that's what you're trying to do with a client. So the 125 years is a normal discretionary trust lasts for 125 years. If you're really clever with protection policies, and if you put a protection policy, let's say you're doing a £900,000 protection policy, you set three of them up at £300,000 each. Each one of them, I'm sorry, I'm going to get a bit technical here. Each one of them will avoid ad hoc 10-year discretionary. I forgot what it's called. It's not terminal. It's a fee
that you've got to pay. Periodic charge.
Periodic charge. Sorry, thank you so much, Ed. A periodic charge. Also, what it does is it allows that money to be protected against several different challenges. One of them I've mentioned to you is the inheritance tax. The other one is a bankruptcy if unfortunately they went bankrupt. Third one is sideways inheritance if they unfortunately got married and the other person, if they got married and unfortunately they passed away, that money could go in a whole different direction to what they needed. And care fees to name a few things. I feel the education of that allows our clients to, I mean, we have nearly 100% hit rate in people putting policies into trust, which is way over the norm. And that is predominantly, I feel, about the education that we provide. We don't take a client on until about, we educate them over 2 or 3 months of meetings. In financial planning, we educate them over 6 to 12 months. We don't take a client on until they've understood all the aspects of it. And then they can have a choice of whether they want to deal with us or whether they want to deal with something else. So what I'm trying to do is build a relationship up with somebody so they feel comfortable and I feel comfortable dealing with them. I hope that answers the question, Ian.
I think indeed it does. And if I can move to Ross, you equally gave me a list of key impacts and recent and proposed changes. Anything that our two previous speakers haven't covered that you'd like to add to that?
And this is kind of going on real experience of having met with some of my clients over the course of the last few months, that there's a double whammy going on here for a lot of people as a result of the changes in the budget. Because if you're a business owner and you own a business of your own of significant value, and you also happen to have a decent sized pension fund, then you've got, you know, two significant assets, which before the budget announcements last year were both exempted from inheritance tax. And from April 26 and April 27, that's going to shift completely. And all of a sudden, you've got, you know, the value of your business above £1 million is going to be exposed to some level of inheritance tax, and all your pension funds potentially coming into that taxable estate as well. So for a lot of people, when we're kind of tracking their potential inheritance tax liability, and I tend to use Voyant as my sort of preferred cash flow modelling tool for that, and Voyant has already built in the upcoming pension changes into their inheritance tax calculation. So if you look at a Voyant scenario that was done earlier in the year, and you look at what the inheritance tax liability was, and then you run that again now, taking into account the changes to pensions which are coming in 2027, you see that kind of sharp spike in the value of that inheritance tax coming onto the pension. And if you happen to be a business owner or a farm owner, then you've also got your sort of business asset coming into that as well. So it's really increasing inheritance tax liabilities for an awful lot of people. And I think for that reason, we're going to see the demand for protection policies significantly increasing as well, because it is the quickest, simplest, least disruptive way of protecting an inheritance tax liability. You don't have to change your asset base. You don't have to give anything away. You can keep a hold of everything you already have and still make provisions for paying the inheritance tax when it comes along. So I think we will see more and more people starting to ask about protection, and more advisors talking to their clients about protection, because that need is going to be much greater.
Yeah, I think certainly on previous similar sessions that we've run on this subject, a number of advisors have said they're seeing an unparalleled level of interest in inheritance tax. Indeed, a lot of clients that they've been trying to suggest to them for some years that they have a significant inheritance tax liability. Now the pension's in play, people seem a whole lot more interested. Ross, can I stay with you? And the next couple of subjects we're going to talk about are the most suitable vehicles for inheritance tax planning. If you could share your views on those and why, and then I'm going to go around the rest of the panelists for their own views. So would you be happy to give us your thoughts on what vehicles you're finding most effective?
So thinking specifically of protection vehicles, do you mean, Ian?
General ways of treating IHT. I don't think we should restrict, while we're primarily here to talk about protection, I don't think we should restrict that.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds a bit twee maybe, but it really does need to be personalised to the individual client sitting in front of you, because it will be very different depending on each person's circumstances. But certainly we might start to see people more open to the idea of gifting in order to reduce their inheritance tax liability. And if they're making either chargeable lifetime transfers or potentially exempt transfers, then they might want to consider a gift inter vivos policy, which is effectively a 7-year term assurance that reduces the cover from year 4 through to 7. To mirror the tapering effect of IHT on those gifts. So gift inter vivos policies, I think, will be important. The market for gift inter vivos policies is not huge. There's not very many providers that are willing to offer it. But of course, you can create the same effect with a series of term assurance policies, with term assurance policies kind of falling off during that taper period, which will give you the same effect, albeit it's a bit more complicated to set up with a number of different policies in place. But I think gift inter vivos and term assurance policies will be very important for those who decide to gift and to try and reduce their estate that way. For those who decide not to do that, then whole of life, I suppose, is the kind of other obvious alternative there. I just, in the process of putting a large whole of life policy in place for clients at the moment. So just to give you a couple of kind of real life figures, which might be helpful. This is a couple who are aged 80 and 76. They're going for £1 million worth of life cover on a whole of life, joint life, second death basis. Reviewable premiums, £1,541 a month. Guaranteed premiums, £2,781 a month. So almost double the monthly rate to go for the guaranteed premiums at the start. The reviewable premiums are guaranteed for the first 10 years. So 10 years into the reviewable policy, they've paid £184,920. 10 years into their guaranteed policy, they've paid £333,720. So significantly higher cost over that initial 10 years. However, the indicative premium at the 10-year anniversary increases from £1,541 to £7,152 per month. And that's only guaranteed for 5 years. At the 15-year anniversary, the indicative premium is £14,385 per month. So 20 years in, you're looking at a total cost of about £1.4 million on the reviewable basis versus £667,000 on the guaranteed basis. So again, I think we have to really think carefully here. Is that client likely to have that size of a liability for the next 15 to 20 years? If you genuinely think that they're not going to do any other kind of estate planning and they really are going to have a liability of that size for the long term, then actually the guaranteed premiums might start to look more attractive. If you think the client's going to be able to mitigate their inheritance tax liability by gifting or moving assets into trust or employing other estate planning strategies, then actually the reviewable premiums can become more helpful, because you're effectively saying, look, you've got a lower cost for 10 years. You've now got 10 years to do some other estate planning to try and reduce the liability, so that when you get to that 10-year anniversary, rather than the premium jumping from £1,500 a month to about £7,000 a month, you can instead reduce the sum assured and try and keep the premiums a bit lower if you've got a lower liability to cover off. So I think the suite of different protection policies that are out there will all fit different circumstances, just depending on how the client is planning to try and tackle the IHT liability.
I think you've made a couple of really interesting points there. Firstly, the one about lack of capacity in certain products, gift, inter vivos, I think I'm right in saying is a two provider market right now. And as indeed is joint life, second death term. I'm surprised we haven't seen more people, more providers coming forward. Perhaps they're waiting until such time as this legislation actually hits the statute book, and then we probably will have a lot of change in that area. But thinking about that, and that was, thank you for that great example of, you know, fixed versus variable, because the fixed cost versus, you know, reviewable premiums is something that the media particularly tend to, I won't say they get wrong, but they don't understand in context. My question to you and to the other panelists actually is, are insurers doing enough to make it easy to give that comparison of what's the, you know, what's the guaranteed premium and what's the variable premium? I mean, if people are thinking about designing new products and coming into the market, should they be doing so in a way that shows very clearly how premiums will change over an extended period of time? So I suppose two questions there. are the current providers doing enough to make that clearly, or do you have to pull together tons of manual quotes? And what else could people do better? I'll come back to you on that, Ross, and then I'm going to come to Harry, who's smiling on that one. So I think you've got something to say. Ross first.
Okay, I'll just go very quickly. The example that I've gave there has come from Royal London. So it's their Pegasus whole of life product. When you run a quote for their whole of life product, the quote gives you the indicative future premiums on a reviewable basis. So it's actually very simple and very easy. They are only indicative premiums, though, and that's where you need to be really careful, because you can set an expectation for the client. Okay, well, I understand what this premium is going to change to at the end of the 10 years. The truth is, it might be very, very different to that by the time you get to that anniversary. So the challenge for the product providers is trying to give people enough information, but trying to do it accurately when even they don't know what the premium is going to change to in 10 years' time. So it's very difficult to do that. But Royal London do give you indicative premiums on their quote. So you can say to the client, look, next 10 years, I can guarantee it's going to be this. At the 10 years, this is what it might change to. But you have to caveat that it might look something quite different to that too.
Great. Harry, to come to you, any particular thoughts on that subject? What's your experience? Who's good? Who needs to do better?
Well, I think we need to do better. I don't think the insurance companies just provide the products, really. It's up to us to do the educational piece for ourselves, understanding how these things work, and then provide those solutions to our clients and give them a choice. I think there's lots of other choices before you go to the protection area. Maybe not the right thing to say in a protection forum. But, you know, a client spending money, what Ross mentioned, gifting, and also doing nothing. Some don't want to pay a premium and stuff like that. And we've got to recognize that some people don't want to do that. For me, I think the reality is the long term planning. You know, when you set up a life insurance policy for inheritance tax planning, a lot of people assume it's going to just get paid out and then that's the end of the policy. If you think about that money sitting in a trust and borrowing some money off that money can actually end up paying maybe two or three generations of inheritance tax if you structure it properly. And that's what I think, is that the protection policies only do one part of the job. The other part of the job moving forward is where the financial planner educates the client and say, what about this? How do we go about doing that? That, I think, is a key element on anything. We shouldn't rely on insurance. We should be looking at the products that are provided, help them to design these products, and then say to them, this is a solution, because we're client-facing, insurers aren't. We should be able to look at the situation and say, what's the problem regarding that? We've solved a problem by creating some money, but we've created another problem. That person's got too much money now. What's the problem and how do we resolve that? That's what I think is for us to understand and for us to educate our clients.